hospital brought in another German and said he wanted to become naturalized. I had never seen the man before, but his friends vouched for him and told me he had been living near the capital for nearly 6 years. The man was quite distinguished, very well-mannered, and appeared in every respect very correct. The request for completing naturalization papers was something I did as a lawyer, so there was nothing unusual in the request. Also, he was being sponsored by two prominent citizens, von Eckstein and Jung. Meanwhile, news that the West German Foreign Office had made preliminary inquiries about extraditing Mengele from Argentina had leaked to the press. By late 1959, the World Jewish Congress was appealing for Auschwitz survivors to come forward to supplement the evidence already gathered by Langbein and the Freiburg court. It seems clear that by now Mengele was considering the possibility of life without Marta and Karl Heinz. As Dr. Sanabria said, "The man sought naturalization only for himself. He didn't have a wife or child with him, and he didn't mention that he had either." As for Mengele's request, Dr. Sanabria may not have seen anything unusual, but Jung and von Eckstein should have known the application was illegal. At that time, applicants for Paraguayan citizenship had to prove they had lived at least 5 continuous years in the country. Mengele had certainly made many visits, but came nowhere near to satisfying the residence requirement, even though von Eckstein and Jung swore in court that he did. Dr. Sanabria, perhaps, also ought to have been alerted to the deficiency, since Mengele gave his permanent address in Paraguay as that of Dr. Sanabria's office, thereby suggesting that he did not actually have a home in the country. Airily dismissing any suggestion that he and Jung perjured themselves, von Eckstein said, "He asked me for citizenship, and he asked Jung, and he asked me if we would be witnesses for him. I said of course I would, and so I signed it, and I became a witness, and he became a citizen." Jung claimed he did not know the law specified a 5-year permanent stay. "That would be silly, because how could anyone say with certainty that a man had lived continuously in Paraguay for 5 years, unless one had actually lived with him? But if the statement I signed is supposed to mean that I had known him for 5 years, then it was true, because I had. Mengele just asked me if I wanted to be a witness, and I said yes. It was as simple as that. I thought it would be nice to have Mengele as a Paraguayan citizen." While Mengele's citizenship papers were being prepared, he was involved in an incident which was used later by some researchers and authors as an important piece of evidence to show that Martin Bormann, Hitler's private secretary and closest confidant in the latter half of the war, was alive and associated with Mengele. A stream of Bormann sightings have been reported since then, to the embarrassment of the newspaper whose suspects, on closer examination, have turned out to be innocent South Americans with only a passing resemblance to Bormann. No proof has ever been provided to counter the conclusion of West German prosecutors in 1973 that a skeleton unearthed half a mile from the site of Hitler's bunker, between the Weidenhammer Bridge and the Lehrte station in Berlin, was that of the former Reichsleiter. As of that date, the West German courts ordered all outstanding warrants to be quashed and future sightings of Bormann to be ignored. But the incident featuring Mengele was first reported in 1966 by a Time Life television production entitled The Search for Vengeance, and was later embroidered by Michael Bar-Zohar in his 1968 book The Avengers. It was further embellished in 1973 by Ladislas Farago in Aftermath, Bormann and the Fourth Reich. All of this revived speculation that Bormann had, after all, eluded the Russian army encircling Berlin in early May 1945. The television documentary and both authors claimed that in the spring of 1959, an Asuncion physician of Austrian nationality, Dr. Otto Biss, was escorted by a woman to the home of Werner Jung after Mengele had failed to diagnose the condition of a mystery guest who was seriously ill. Bar Zohar reported Dr. Biss as saying, "I examined the sick man and spoke to him in German, but the sick man wouldn't answer in that language or in any other of the European languages I know. He insisted on speaking in bad Spanish. So I found it rather difficult to get any help from him to establish the nature of his illness." The other doctor realized this, and he bent over the sick man and said, "You may speak German." And to my great surprise, the men then spoke in fluent German. Dr. Biss, who said his mystery patient had a scar on his forehead, went on, "A few days later, a friend of mine came to see me in great excitement. He told me he had met the woman who had come to me, and that the man I had seen professionally was Martin Bormann. I got hold of some photographs of Hitler's right-hand man at once. There was no possible doubt. The man I had seen was older than the man in the photos, but it was the same man, all right. He was certainly Martin Bormann." Ladislas Farago repeated Bar Zohar's interview in his book, published 6 years later, as one of many incidents, some based on documents of dubious origin cited to prove that Bormann was alive. The whole episode is worth dredging up only because it is one of many interesting examples of the sometimes wishful thinking engendered by Nazi hunters, the kind that created such an elusive aura around Mengele. Interviewed 10 years later, at the age of 85, Dr. Biss was still convinced that his patient was Martin Bormann. Had Jung been interviewed, a much more plausible interpretation would have emerged. "I don't ever recall Mengele treating anyone in my house, but I myself was sick, and I do remember being treated by Biss at my house for a stomach ailment. Mengele may have been there at the time, I don't remember." Unfortunately for Werner Jung, pictures of him taken around 1959 show a remarkable likeness to the wartime photographs of Bormann, and these pictures convinced Dr. Biss that he had just treated the world's most wanted war criminal. The reality of fugitive life in Asunción at this time was much less Machiavellian. Bormann almost certainly was dead, and although Mengele was now wanted by the Germans, his application for citizenship in his own name was still proceeding smoothly. As a precaution, however, Hans Rudel asked the Interior Minister, Edgar Insfran, to expedite the case. Mengele knew he had succeeded when, on October 24, 1959, he was issued an identity card as José Mengele. 2 weeks later, the Asunción police gave him a certificate of good conduct and residency. His citizenship papers were vouched for by the obliging Dr. Sanabria. His application was brought before Judge Luis Martínez Miltos. Court proceedings show that the police good conduct certificate was enough to satisfy Judge Miltos that there were no outstanding legal or police records which could hinder his obtaining Paraguayan citizenship through naturalization. The judge was also satisfied that Mengele had resided permanently in this country for more than 5 years, and that he had shown repeatedly his intention to give up his former nationality, as it is backed up by the statements of his witnesses, Werner Jung and Alejandro von Eckstein. By law, Mengele had to deposit the sum of 5,000 guaranis, in 1959 the equivalent of $41. All that was required to complete the process was the rubber stamp approval of the Supreme Court, where the papers were duly filed. Almost at the time when the Supreme Court's approval was due, Mengele received word in Asunción that his father had died. Any thoughts Mengele might have entertained of going to Günzburg for the funeral were eliminated when he read the warning from his family. Local police informers had notified them that two undercover agents from the LKA, the German FBI, would attend the funeral in the hope of finding the fugitive doctor. Mengele instead arranged to have a wreath delivered to the grave, marked only with a wide sash inscribed, "Greetings from afar." Within days after Mengele learned of his father's death, the West German embassy in Asunción discovered that Josef Mengele was in fact living right under their noses in Paraguay. On November 13th, 4 days before Mengele's father died, the West German consul, Winfried Engermann, asked the Paraguayan Minister of the Interior if he might make a brief inspection of Mengele's file. The request, in turn, alerted the head of police investigations in Asunción to make further inquiries of the Argentine Federal Police concerning José Mengele's background. However, before the Paraguayans allowed Engermann to review the Mengele file, they removed any relevant information, and Engermann found the file useless. At the same time that the West Germans were reviewing the file in Asunción, Interpol headquarters in Paris asked the naturalization section of the Paraguayan Ministry of the Interior to forward a copy of his file to their offices in Buenos Aires and Paris. But Mengele had little to fear from this private organization, impressive though its membership list of more than 100 countries seems to be. Interpol's contribution to the Mengele hunt was desultory. Files in the Brazilian and Paraguayan branches of Interpol contain mostly second-hand information. This continued to be the pattern in Interpol's approach. Hunting war criminals has never been one of Interpol's priorities. It claims its broad charter prohibits this on the grounds that Nazi crimes were of a political nature as opposed to crimes of common law. Its hierarchy also has an unhealthy history of close connections with National Socialism. In 1939, Reinhard Heydrich, chief of the Gestapo, was voted president of Interpol. In December 1941, Interpol moved its headquarters to the fashionable Berlin suburb of Wannsee, where it shared a villa with the Gestapo. Heydrich even made Interpol a division within the SD, the security police. When Heydrich was assassinated in June 1942, Himmler chose Heydrich's successor at the Gestapo, Ernst Kaltenbrunner, to replace him as Interpol's president. After Kaltenbrunner was hanged at Nuremberg in October 1946, a Belgian member of Interpol's executive committee, Florent E. Louage, became president. He was succeeded in 1956 by Jean Nepot, who had collaborated with the wartime Vichy government in France. In 1968, Interpol elected Paul Dickhoff president. He was found to have been an SS officer during the war, having worked in the very villa where Interpol was then headquartered. Nonetheless, he remained president until 1972. By mid-November 1959, both the Paraguayan Interior Ministry's naturalization section and the Paraguayan police knew that an extradition request was underway for Josef Mengele for war crimes. Alejandro von Eckstein, President Stroessner's friend, also admits to having known about this interest on the part of the West Germans and Interpol. But no one thought the circumstances warranted postponing Mengele's application for citizenship. Nor is there any evidence that these august Paraguayan governmental bodies brought this new information to the attention of the Supreme Court. If they did, the court ignored them. On November 27th, José Mengele was issued his naturalization certificate, number 809. On the other side of the world, meanwhile, another government had been taking an interest in the case of Josef Mengele. Unlike the West Germans, the Israelis had little faith in the slow, ponderous, bureaucratic machinations of extradition requests to South America. Their skepticism was fully justified. On October 27th, The Argentine Foreign Ministry told the West German Embassy in Buenos Aires, informally, that they must expect their extradition request to be refused, on the grounds that the allegations against Mengele were of a political nature. For some time, Israel's view had been that as long as Bonn stuck to the strict boundaries of international law, they were unlikely to succeed in bringing Nazi fugitives to trial in West Germany. The Israelis preferred to act within the broader concepts of international justice, as Mengele himself soon discovered. Chapter 7. Operation Mengele. The decision to deploy the limited resources of the Mossad to track down Nazi criminals marked a major departure from its role as Israel's foreign intelligence gathering and special missions service. Until the late 1950s, events leading to the Suez Crisis and, increasingly, the influence of the Soviet Union had been the Mossad's chief concern under its resourceful chief, Issa Harel. One of the more spectacular intelligence feats of Harel's fledgling service was his Moscow resident's success in scooping the Americans and the British by procuring the full text of Premier Nikita Khrushchev's explosive denunciation of Stalin in February 1956. In Harel's hands lay one of the West's most powerful propaganda weapons. Khrushchev, in a 3-hour speech, had laid bare the totalitarian savagery of his predecessor at a secret session of the Soviet Communist Party Congress. The stature of the diminutive Harel, just over 5 feet tall, was elevated overnight as he brought his prize to Washington to negotiate a deal. Publicly, the Central Intelligence Agency took the credit as news agencies broadcast the leaked text around the world. Membership in the Western Communist parties was decimated almost overnight. Privately, Harel secured a new intelligence-sharing agreement with the Americans. With it, the Mossad's now legendary aura of intrigue was born. Late in 1957, Harel received a telephone call that was soon to give the Mossad's reputation a public face. Walter Eitan, Director General of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, was on the line from Jerusalem requesting an urgent meeting. It was not a matter that could be discussed on the telephone. That evening, the two men met at a cafe in Ramat Gan, where an emotional Eitan told Harel that the Foreign Office had received word from West Germany that Adolf Eichmann was alive and that his address in Argentina was known. Later, in his own account of Operation Eichmann, Harel wrote that it may have been instinct that told him that this time the information was accurate. For most of the 1950s, tips on Eichmann had proved to be wrong. The Israelis did not even have certain proof that Eichmann was alive. Back in Tel Aviv, Harel spent most of the night reading Eichmann's file. It revealed how the SS bureaucrat had so zealously administered the destruction of the European Jews. By morning, Harel had resolved that, come hell or high water, Eichmann would be caught. No agency in the entire world, no government, no police were looking for him to answer for his crimes. People were tired of atrocity stories. Their one desire was to dismiss those unspeakable happenings from their minds. They maintained that in any event there was no punishment on earth to fit the perpetrations of outrages of such magnitude, and that they were reconciled to the violation of law and perversion of justice. Harel had no difficulty persuading Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion that capturing Eichmann was a proper function for the Mossad. A deep and trusting relationship had developed between the two men in the first precarious months of the new State of Israel, when it was under threat from the Arabs outside and from Menachem Begin's right-wing Irgun Tzva Lyumi within. Then in charge of the Department of Internal Affairs, the Israeli equivalent of the FBI, Harel had neutralized the factions bent on civil war, both Begin's group and the remnants of the underground Stern terrorist gang that was opposed to the terms of the UN ceasefire in the first Arab-Israeli war following independence. He accomplished this by flushing out the Irgun and Stern leaders and their arms dumps. Characteristically of Harel, the operation was carried out with zeal and determination, but not as revenge. The rebels were told, some personally by Harel himself, that the new state of Israel could not and would not tolerate private armies. Pre-state Israel, then, and its early traumas were in Harel's bones. He was not a survivor of the Holocaust, but he was very much a state pioneer, a paternalistic keeper of its conscience. And so it followed that to Harel and the men under his command, capturing Eichmann was a national and humane mission. Israel, he said, was the only country in the world determined to leave no legal stone unturned. And by the rules of law, logic, and historical justice, was the state most competent to pass judgment. But locating Eichmann precisely, proving his identity, kidnapping him, and spiriting him out of a country thousands of miles away posed enormous logistical problems for the Mossad. And although Harel had succeeded in persuading Ben-Gurion to allow a generous budget for the Mossad, Operation Eichmann promised to devour a substantial part of it, as Harel himself explained in his autobiographical account of the affair. In fact, when Nahum Amir, our travel agent in Europe, had told me that by his calculations it would cost a fortune to send a special plane to take Eichmann to Israel, I had said, "To make the investment worthwhile, we'll try to bring Mengele with us as well." Capturing Mengele was not quite the budgetary afterthought that this quotation from Harel's account implies. As he said later, "I thought it important for Israel to have a Holocaust trial, and I very much wanted Mengele there as well. A trial would have allowed the world to explore a truly evil mind." Although the Mossad's intelligence on Mengele was not as accurate as it was on Eichmann, it was clear from the few scraps they had that the Auschwitz doctor was leading a wholly different lifestyle than that of his murderous counterpart. Mengele lived under his own name. Eichmann used a pseudonym. Mengele's wife, Marta, was in the telephone book, although at an old address. The Israelis even had some details of Mengele's business activities. One complication, however, threatened to torpedo both operations. Late in 1959, newspaper stories on Eichmann and Mengele began to appear. Ben-Gurion was asked in the Israeli parliament what steps were being taken to bring Eichmann to trial. Fearing that publicity might alert both men who knew each other, Harel encouraged false press speculation that Eichmann had been seen in Kuwait. One of the few men outside Israel who knew the truth was Dr. Fritz Bauer, public prosecutor for the state of Hesse in West Germany. In September 1957, he had sent word to the Israelis that Eichmann had been traced. The message to Jerusalem was dispatched in the strictest secrecy. Only he and the Prime Minister for Hesse, August Zinn, were privy to the information. Harel agreed with Bauer that the Bonn government was most unlikely to deal with Eichmann. "Bauer told me that no one else knew," said Harel. "He said that he didn't trust the German Foreign Office, and he didn't trust his embassy in Buenos Aires. He said we were the only people who could be relied upon to do anything with the information." Aside from the fact that the West German ambassador in Buenos Aires was Werner Junkers, a wartime Foreign Office Nazi functionary, Bauer had one other reason for deeply mistrusting his own countrymen. He had been jailed twice by the Nazis, both before and during the war, because he was a Jew. Twice he managed to escape, the second time to Sweden, and on his return vowed he would do all he could to bring men like Mengele and Eichmann to trial. The source of Bauer's information on Eichmann was a series of letters from a German Jew named Lothar Herrmann, who lived in the remote Argentine town of Coronel Suarez. Harel sent agents out to meet Herrmann, and at first he did not impress them as a credible witness. For one thing, he was blind, a condition that did not seem to lend itself to tracking Nazis. But after thorough questioning, the Israelis learned that Herrmann's attractive 18-year-old daughter, by an extraordinary coincidence, was being pursued by a young German from Buenos Aires who called himself Nicholas Eichmann. As their relationship developed, the young Eichmann boasted to the girl that his father had held an important position during the war and regretted that the Nazis had not managed to wipe out all the Jews. Herrmann correctly concluded that his daughter was dating the son of Adolf Eichmann, whose name had often been mentioned in the Argentine press. The Israelis employed Herrmann to help them in the investigation, and within several months, Herrmann reported that he had found where Eichmann lived, 4261 Chacabuco Street, in the Olivos suburb of Buenos Aires. Herrmann was convinced that the registered Austrian owner, Francisco Schmidt, was in fact Eichmann. In his first report to Tel Aviv, Herrmann presumed with certainty that Schmidt and Eichmann were one and the same man. The Israelis took over the investigation, scoured Schmidt's background, and put him under surveillance. It took one Israeli agent little time to determine that Schmidt could not be Eichmann. Based on this discovery, and Herrmann's sometimes dubious claims for expenses, Harel began to lose faith in him. Harel was nothing if not consistent. Correct to an almost puritanical degree in his private life, he expected the same high standards from his men, even if they were employed on a freelance basis. In any case, the hunt for Adolf Eichmann temporarily lost its momentum, as Harel explained. These findings damaged Herrmann's trustworthiness irretrievably. In August 1958, instructions were given to allow our contact with Herrmann to lapse gradually. Yet Harel and his agent in the field had made a serious error of judgment. Herrmann had in fact been right all along in pinpointing Eichmann's address. His mistake had been in assuming that the Austrian owner, Schmidt, was Eichmann. From Harel's own account of Operation Eichmann, it appears that not even the Israelis bothered at this stage to check on the identities of all the occupants of the house. Had they done so, they would have found that there were at least two tenants under the same roof. Herrmann had reported to Tel Aviv as early as May 1958 that 4261 Chacabuco Street was split into two units, with two electricity meters registered in two names, Dagoto and Clement, or Clements. Harel implicitly blamed Herrmann for the oversight because, he said, he had never even mentioned the possibility that it was one of the tenants of the house, either Dagoto or Clement, who could be Eichmann. In fact, a more thorough investigation by the Israelis might have put Adolf Eichmann in their hands by late 1958. Then residing openly in Buenos Aires under his own name, moreover, Josef Mengele might well have been part of the roundup. As it was, the Israelis' failure to keep faith with Herrmann and exhaust all possibilities caused a delay of 18 months, by which time Mengele was spending most of his time in Paraguay. According to one senior intelligence officer, the Eichmann case was closed. Harel basically didn't believe the information that Eichmann was using the name Clement, he said. The case was reopened by the determined lobbying of Dr. Fritz Bauer, who flew to Jerusalem in December 1959. Bauer angrily complained to Israel's Attorney General, Chaim Cohen, that Jerusalem had not acted on the information he confided to them late in 1957. Bauer said he had just received independent confirmation from an SS informant that Eichmann was living under the name Ricardo Clement and that he had fled Europe in 1950 using that alias. The Attorney General asked Harel to reopen the Eichmann case. Harel responded by borrowing Zvi Aharoni, then chief interrogator of Shin Bet, the Israeli FBI. Harel dispatched him to Buenos Aires to check out the Chacabuco Street address for the third time. By a series of ingenious methods, including tailing one of Eichmann's sons on his motorbike and talking to neighbors without raising the slightest suspicion, Aharoni, with assistance from local Mossad agents, discovered that Eichmann had indeed lived at 4261 Chacabuco Street and had recently moved to a drab single-story stucco house in Garibaldi Street. At some risk, Aharoni's team snapped several photographs of Eichmann with a hidden briefcase camera while talking to him. There was another bonus, too. Aharoni discovered that his quarry was a man with a regular job and settled in his habits. His orderly routine, Aharoni reported back to Tel Aviv, boded well for a successful kidnapping. Mengele, by contrast, was not a creature of habit. Unknown to the Israelis, sometime late in March or early April 1960, Mengele returned from Paraguay to Buenos Aires for one of his periodic reunions with his wife and stepson. Unnerved by news of the German arrest warrant for him, Marta and Karl Heinz had moved into a boarding house in the Vicente López district of the city. Coincidentally, shortly after Mengele's return to Buenos Aires, Harel decided to give the final go-ahead to Operation Eichmann, and Mengele was also chosen as a target for the Mossad. In April 1960, shortly before Harel's departure for Buenos Aires to take personal charge of the operation, an unprecedented move for an intelligence chief, he dug out Mengele's file and wrote down all the crucial information in a code known only to him. It was a wise precaution for Israel's intelligence chief to take in the event of discovery by the Argentine authorities. Although Harel had resolved to give himself up in such a crisis, he would have had his hands full trying to justify one infringement of Argentine sovereignty, let alone two. Harel's plan was to go after Mengele once Eichmann was caught and held in one of the Israelis' seven safe houses in Buenos Aires, while they waited for the departure of a special El Al Britannia aircraft that would fly their prisoner home. The kidnapping was set for May 11th. Harel had won the agreement of the national airline to divert one of its planes in order to bring a delegation of Israeli dignitaries, led by UN representative Abba Even, to attend Argentina's celebration of 150 years independence. But the aircraft could not arrive before May 19th because the Argentinians could not receive the Israeli delegation before 2 p.m. that day. Harel wanted to get Eichmann out of the country as soon as possible, within 36 hours at the outside. Yet that would be too soon for the Israeli delegation's planned departure. It was decided, therefore, that the delegation would have to return by scheduled airliner. But there was one complication. Even had said he wished to travel back on the El Al plane. Since the Eichmann mission was so secret that none of the delegates, including Even, knew the real reason for the plane's journey to Buenos Aires, Harel decided that Even and his colleagues would have to remain in the dark. Even was therefore told that the reason he and the other diplomats would have to return on another airline was that the airport fees for keeping the El Al plane in Buenos Aires for several days were too high. Since the El Al plane would depart from Buenos Aires on May 20th, Harel would have just 9 precious days in which to capture Mengele. On May 11th, 1960, Adolf Eichmann finished work at 7:10 p.m. at the Mercedes-Benz plant, where he was an assembly line foreman, and boarded the bus home to Garibaldi Street. He left the bus at his usual stop, paying no attention to a nearby car with its hood up. 2 men were bent over the engine, apparently encountering mechanical problems. Nor was he unduly concerned by the presence of another car with 3 men inside, parked 30 yards from the bus stop. As Eichmann walked past the disabled car, the rear doors swung open and 4 men pounced on him and bundled him inside. The abduction took less than a minute. Eichmann did not offer much resistance. He spoke only 6 words before being bound and gagged. "I am resigned to my fate," he replied to Aharoni, who was driving the car and who had warned him not to resist. Eichmann's eyes were covered with a pair of opaque goggles, and he was shoved onto the car floor. An hour later, the Israelis arrived at a safe house codenamed Tira in the Florencio Varela district of Buenos Aires. With Eichmann safely in Israeli hands, Harel turned his attention to Mengele. During that unenterprising, though by no means inactive period preceding the arrival of the plane, with all the preparations for transporting Eichmann at an advanced stage, I decided to do something about Mengele. Everything we knew about this man was written in my notebook, in a personal code which only I could decipher, and even I had some difficulty. The task of interrogating Eichmann was given to Aharoni. He spoke fluent German and had spent the last 2 years of the war interrogating captured German soldiers at the British 8th Army headquarters in Egypt, Italy, and Austria. In 1949, he had joined Shin Bet and became its chief interrogator. According to Harel, Mengele was the only subject Eichmann refused to talk about during his interrogation. "I asked Kenneth," Harel's code name for Aharoni, "to question Eichmann about Mengele. I told him not to ask if he knew Mengele or where he was hiding, but to tell him that we knew the man was in Buenos Aires and he must give us the exact address." Eichmann's response wasn't very encouraging. He didn't disclaim acquaintance with Mengele, but he said he didn't know where he was and had never heard whether he was in Argentina or anywhere else in South America. Eichmann simply refused to say more, and to justify his refusal, he told Kenneth he didn't want to betray his friends. I regarded his reply as confirmation of 2 things: that Mengele was not far away, and that he and Eichmann had been in contact. When Kenneth continued to press him, Eichmann brought up another argument in support of his refusal. He was afraid, he said, of what might happen to his wife and children. I told Kenneth to promise Eichmann that we would undertake his family's support if he would give us Mengele's address, but all our urgings and promises were of no avail. My impression was that he went into a panic when we demanded Mengele's location, and I felt that his obduracy stemmed not from any sense of loyalty, but from sheer fright. Eventually, Eichmann mentioned during the interrogation that Mengele might be found at a boarding house that had served as a refuge for several Nazis. It was run by a German woman named Jürmann. In fact, Harel had known of this house, but he was excited to hear Eichmann corroborate it. "I was rather astonished that this information was well established," he said. It was an isolated villa located on a narrow lane, surrounded by a white picket fence. To the consternation of Aharoni and several other senior members of the Eichmann task force, Harel decided to mount a surveillance on the house. Aharoni explained. I don't think I'd even heard of who Mengele was at that stage. His name hadn't surfaced in the newspapers, and I must admit I was concerned only with getting Eichmann back to Israel. Harel had said nothing about this to us before. When he did, some of us felt that it was too ambitious and that it would risk the success of the Eichmann operation. As soon as Eichmann admitted his name, I, personally, wanted to get back home. I was very relieved the operation had succeeded so far, and I didn't want anything to happen that might endanger the next stage of getting him out of Argentina. I thought we could always try Mengele another time. But Harel would not be dissuaded from making one attempt to capture Mengele. His problem was a shortage of agents. Of the members of the task force, only Menashe might be able to give me part of his time, he wrote. And when Shalom Dani heard about the new assignment, he demanded that I allow him to take part in it. But these two were not enough. I had to have more, especially people who spoke Spanish. Harel requested the help of a third agent, Meir Lavi, who had acted as liaison man on the night of Eichmann's abduction. Lavi and his wife had emigrated to Argentina, and Harel considered having them rent a room at Mrs. Yerman's boarding house. But he abandoned the plan after meeting Lavi, because Lavi did not speak Spanish well enough to convince anybody that he was Argentinian. However, Lavi introduced Harel to another Israeli couple, Ada and Binyamin Efrat, who lived in Buenos Aires and who had the qualifications. Harel was impressed. The following morning, Binyamin Efrat was sitting opposite me in my on-duty café. One look was enough to tell me that he was the man I wanted. He spoke Spanish fluently and looked exactly like an average Argentinian. He had heard about Mengele, but didn't know much about him. I told him we had information that this sadist was in Buenos Aires, and we were trying to locate him. He said he was prepared, without any reservations, to undertake any assignment that he had to with Mengele. That evening, the Efrats discovered from residents in neighboring villas that the tenants of the boarding house were North Americans. The next morning, Dani was assigned to watch the house to see if any of the tenants looked German or American. To lend an air of plausibility, said Harel, he ordered Dani to go with a woman, so he chose Ada Efrat. They saw no one who resembled Mengele. The next day, Lavi and Ada's husband, Binyamin, took over the surveillance. Lavi had a briefcase camera, and Harel told him to photograph everyone arriving at and leaving the house. But all they saw were children. And although Lavi used the camera, the pictures did not come out clearly. It was therefore impossible to know if Mengele's stepson, Karl Heinz, was among them. The following morning, Binyamin asked the mailman for the address of his uncle, a Dr. Menele. He told the mailman he knew Dr. Menele lived in the area, but he did not have his exact address. The mailman told Binyamin that a man by that name had lived at the Yerman boarding house until a few weeks ago, maybe a month. But the mailman did not have a forwarding address, nor did the nearby post office. The letters that had come for Mengele had been addressed to him in his real name, but the chief postal clerk told Efrat that he did not have his new address, and that all of his letters were being marked "Return to Sender." Not wanting to admit defeat, Harel decided to pursue one further lead. Word had reached the Israelis about Mengele's small garage workshop, where he had employed a handful of people to make machine parts for the textile business, as well as furniture and children's toys. They knew that Mengele had at one time called himself Gregor. There was always the hope that Mengele had not severed his connections with the garage when he moved out of his house a month ago, said Harel. he briefed Binyamin to check out the garage with the cover story that he represented a big garage and needed a large quantity of left-hand screws, having failed to find any ready-made ones in the shops. At the garage, Binyamin told the secretary that Mr. Gregor's lathes had been recommended to him, and he asked to see him. Harel described the encounter. The secretary asked him to sit down and left the room. Binyamin heard her talking to somebody outside, though he couldn't catch the drift of their conversation. She came back, scrutinized him without saying a word, and went out again. Several minutes later, she appeared and told him that they had nobody there by the name of Gregor, otherwise she would have told him immediately she did not know the name. Harel therefore reasoned that Mengele still had some connection with the workshop. Little did he know that Mengele had severed all links with it 2 years earlier, though the staff had doubtless been briefed not to answer any questions from strangers about Dr. Gregor. In any event, Harel's ignorance was academic. He gave up trying to find Mengele through the workshop because, as he admitted, the only agents he could spare from Operation Eichmann lacked experience in undercover activities. If we had a team of professionals like the task force at present occupied with Eichmann, who could invest the necessary time, patience, and skill, but I had at my disposal, and for a few days only, a handful of people lacking experience in undercover activities, I had no choice but to give up trying to find Mengele that way. Instead, Harel drew up a final plan to capture Mengele before May 20th, the deadline when the El Al Britannia aircraft had to leave Buenos Aires with Eichmann on board. He urgently cabled Tel Aviv and instructed them to send on the El Al Britannia a team of his own men trained as commandos. His plan was to storm the boarding house only hours before the Britannia was due to return to Israel with Eichmann on board. I was considering a commando operation on the house with the object of checking the identity of all the tenants of the house, and if Mengele was there, just to take him with force. What I had in mind was to bring Mengele to the plane just before takeoff, once Eichmann was safely on board, and to put him on at the last moment. Harel dispatched two men to make a final check on the boarding house in Vicente Lopez. Binyamin Efrat would pose as a repairman for the water heater, while Meir Lavi would pretend he was delivering a parcel. The repairman did manage to gain access, and found, as the neighbors had said, that Americans were living at the house, and that there was no sign of Mengele. The delivery man could not find a plausible pretext for going to the house. Instead, he merely telephoned the American manager and questioned her about previous tenants. Harel was furious at this breach of security. Failure to stick to instructions could have warned Mengele had he been in the house. Efrat's and Lavi's results were, Harel said, a bitter disappointment. Though I knew the prospects of finding Mengele at his old address were pretty poor, I nevertheless hoped that luck might have been on our side. It was hard to reconcile myself to the fact that we missed the opportunity of capturing the murderous doctor by as little as a couple of weeks. Harel remains convinced to this day that Mengele had been at the boarding house only a matter of weeks before. In fact, Mengele had spent most of his time since May 1959 in Paraguay, though he did make occasional visits to Buenos Aires in order to see Marta and Karl Heinz. It may well have been in the aftermath of one of these visits that Harel's agents picked up clues of his recent presence. Either way, the Mossad team's main task had yet to be completed. At 9:30 p.m., the Israelis successfully transported a drugged Adolf Eichmann past the security guards at Azeiza International Airport and placed him on board the chartered El Al plane. A crude attempt has since been made to smear the prestige of this classic and daring operation with a set of documents prepared by CIDE, the intelligence organization which reports directly to the President of the Argentine Republic, then Arturo Frondizi. While the documents themselves appear to be genuine, what they report must be in doubt. CIDE claims that each stage of the Eichmann kidnapping, from beginning to end, was followed by the Argentine intelligence services, who knew that Mossad agents were operating in Buenos Aires soon after they arrived. They even claim that one intelligence officer witnessed the entire abduction. The CIDE reports are based partially on a report by the Alien Control Office of Coordinación Federal, the Argentine CIA, which claims to have detected the presence of Israeli commandos in the Republic of Argentina as early as December 1959. It says Commander Jorge Messina, chief of the Argentine Intelligence Service, under direct instructions from President Frondizi, ordered all Argentine security services to refrain from interfering with Israeli actions and merely to monitor their conduct. The report claims the greatest contribution to the success of the Eichmann abduction came at Azazel Airport when the Israelis attempted to pass the drugged Eichmann off as an ill member of the plane's crew. Inspector Hector Rodriguez Morgado of the Alien Police is said to have replaced the regular immigration personnel with his own agents and instructed them to let the Israelis pass without incident. These extraordinary claims should be judged in the light of what must otherwise have been the acute embarrassment of the Argentine intelligence services when, at 4 p.m. on May 23rd, Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion made one of the most important announcements in the short history of Israel's parliament, the Knesset. "I have to announce that a short time ago, one of the greatest Nazi war criminals was found by the Israeli security services, Adolf Eichmann, who was responsible, together with the Nazi leaders, for what they called the final solution of the Jewish problem, that is, the extermination of 6 million Jews of Europe. Adolf Eichmann is already under arrest in Israel, and he will shortly be brought to trial in Israel under the Nazis and Nazi Collaborators Law of 1950. If in fact President Frondizi did go to the extraordinary lengths of personally ordering his intelligence services to stand by while Argentine sovereignty was violated, even to assist at the airport because he did not wish the Israelis to be hindered in their task, he certainly allowed an elaborate smokescreen to be laid at the United Nations. On June 5th, Argentina requested and received an urgent meeting of the Security Council, which unanimously voted to condemn Israel for the violation of the sovereign rights of the Argentine Republic, resulting from the illicit and clandestine transfer of Eichmann to Israel. Even countries friendly to Israel were vehement in their criticism. The idea that any Argentine president had greater responsibility to the state of Israel than to the sovereignty of his own country is surely fanciful. The most plausible explanation is that the Argentine intelligence services were so badly caught out that they covered their dereliction by faking their reports after the kidnapping. The kidnapping provoked a torrent of diplomatic rhetoric about the sanctity of sovereignty and the like. A breach of sovereignty it certainly had been. Yet the bedlam afflicting Argentina's bureaucracy, when West Germany requested Mengele's extradition just a few weeks later, showed that Israel's mistrust was justified all along. Fueled by Argentina's spasm of righteous indignation, the Eichmann kidnapping unleashed a wave of anti-Semitism that spread like a brush fire across South America. In the face of the UN furor, there was little Israel could do. Meanwhile, Jewish cemeteries were desecrated, Hebrew schools were set on fire, several Jewish restaurants were machine-gunned, and synagogues were bombed. In Colombia, Nazis held a memorial service for those war criminals executed at Nuremberg. Fascist youth groups held rallies in almost every South American capital. The home of the Israeli ambassador to Montevideo was bombed. A young Jewish woman, Graciela Sirota, believed to be the daughter of the owner of the safe house where Eichmann had been held by the Israelis, was kidnapped, sexually abused, and tortured. A swastika burned into her breast. Another young Jewish girl, Meta Penyarek, suspected of having brought food to the safe house during Eichmann's detention, was kidnapped and murdered. The noted Jewish scholar, Maximo Handel, was attacked by a group of Nazi thugs who beat him unconscious and cut swastikas into his body. Despite these outbursts of anti-Semitism, Harel pressed on with his attempt to track down Josef Mengele. "Mengele," he said, "burned like a fire in my bones." Back in Tel Aviv, Harel set up a special unit to track down major Nazi criminals, with Mengele heading the list. The headquarters for this operation was the Mossad's European station in Paris. The man in charge was Eichmann's formidable interrogator, Zvi Aharoni, who had run him to the ground in Buenos Aires before the kidnap team moved in. Harel had secured Aharoni's permanent transfer from Shin Bet to the Mossad. From the spring of 1961 to the end of 1962, several agents from the Eichmann team were sent to Europe and South America. In Europe, their assignment was to try to penetrate Mengele's family circle and shadow his mentor, the Luftwaffe ace Hans Rudel. In South America, the task was to infiltrate Mengele's Nazi friends. Harel claimed that the attempt to capture Mengele cost more money and manpower than Operation Eichmann, but Harel himself was to pay a heavy price. While he enjoyed the loyalty and respect of the majority of his team, there were those outside the Mossad who believed that its strained resources should have been more profitably used elsewhere. Although Harel did not know it then, his decision to concentrate on finding Nazis at the expense of other pressing tasks marked the beginning of the end of a distinguished career, and the end of the hunt for Mengele. Chapter 8. One Step Ahead. Memories of the homely embrace of Gunzburg and the splendor of the rolling Bavarian pasture were now just nostalgic stabs of pain to Josef Mengele. South America was to be a life sentence after the Eichmann kidnapping, that much was clear. A period of gnawing anxiety followed, while Mengele and other fugitives waited for news of Eichmann's ultimate fate after word spread that he was missing, presumed kidnapped, and in Israeli hands. One of father's friends, also an SS member, organized a network of checks at the harbors and airports, said Eichmann's eldest son, Nicholas. There was no harbor, railway station, airport, or important intersection that did not have one of our men stationed there, in the hope of intercepting Eichmann when his abductors tried to move him out of the country. This was how the small fry came forward to help, while the big fish simply ran away. Lying low in Alban Krug's farmhouse in southern Paraguay, one big fish was shaking like a jellyfish. The former Iron Cross hero was stricken with panic as his worst fears were confirmed by Ben-Gurion's announcement to the Israeli parliament. A few days later, Mengele wrote that the situation had become unmanageable. His decision to make a permanent move to Paraguay a year earlier had clearly dismayed his wife, Marta, who argued that he would still be safe in Buenos Aires. But Mengele had no intention of returning there. "It seems to me that things are coming to a head, and might bring a drastic solution. Finally, everyone will acknowledge how right an earlier conduct was, and that at the time their advice was nonsense. That is now incontestable. But no one should blame the others. I alone knew and must know what I should and should not do. I hope my nearest will now respond cleverly and reasonably, in order not to again endanger the new start. What is nevertheless depressing is how the entire situation has become unmanageable. Despite this, I am somehow in a good frame of mind and optimistic. To Mengele, the situation had become unmanageable because, contrary to popular mythology, he did not have a network of armed guards and the protection of President Stroessner. Indeed, the Paraguayan Interior Minister, Edgar Insfrán, was the only senior member of the government who had any idea about Mengele's wartime background. It had been explained by Hans Rudel confidentially when he asked that Mengele's citizenship application be expedited because of problems back home. The stark truth was that the only protection Mengele could rely on was that of Alban Krug. Krug may have been a muscular man, but his armory consisted of precisely one pistol. What Krug lacked in firepower, however, he made up for in loyalty to his fugitive guest. His brother, Ewald, explained, "How is it possible for one single man, Mengele, to have killed so many people? He actually saved several lives in Auschwitz. Mengele did other things than what they say. He was there to select those who would live and those who would die. Don't you think in reality he did this to save lives? Why do you think Rudolf Hess is still in prison? He is a very old man. Look what the Jews did to Eichmann. It was terrible. These people only want to shame the Germans. It's all the fault of the United States, which allows itself to be controlled by the Jews. The true war criminals for having destroyed Germany are in the United States. Germany was the last hope of the world to contain communism. But don't you believe that Germany is destroyed? The United States did not win the war, and there are people ready to help us here in South America." While Mengele was living in fear for his life in Paraguay, in Buenos Aires, the bureaucratic hunt involving West Germany's extradition request was progressing at a slow pace. Since Marta was still resident in Buenos Aires, the West Germans believed that Mengele would return there. But the arrest warrant took so long to process that by the time it had legal status in Argentina, Mengele was already hiding at Alban Krug's farmhouse in Paraguay. The extradition process had begun with all due urgency and secrecy. On June 7, 1959, 2 days after the arrest warrant was issued, the Foreign Office in Bonn cabled the West German Embassy in Buenos Aires to make inquiries about the prospects for extradition. But then the delays began. His Excellency, the ambassador, the ex-Nazi Werner Junkers, was in charge. He had been von Ribbentrop's special wartime plenipotentiary to the southeast region of Yugoslavia. Junkers now claims not to remember anything connected with the Mengele case while his embassy was handling the extradition, although the case attracted enormous publicity in the European and South American newspapers at the time. It is worth recording in full a June 1985 German television interview with the former ambassador. Interviewer: "Were you confronted with the Mengele case in your time as ambassador?" Junkers: "I can't remember." Interviewer: "In 1959, during your time, the first international arrest warrant was issued. Do you know about that?" Junkers: "No, I don't know anything about that." Interviewer: "In 1959 or 1960, an extradition warrant went to the Argentine authorities. Do you know anything about that?" Junkers: "No, I also don't know anything about that." Interviewer: "While you were ambassador, did you ever hear the name Josef Mengele mentioned?" Junkers: Not that I can remember. Junkers's amnesia aside, the first of many stages in a complex extradition request took an extraordinary length of time. For reasons never satisfactorily explained, the Argentine Consul General in Munich, Alberto A. Madoni, did not receive the warrant until March 11, 1960, a full 9 months after it was issued. Another 2 months passed before Madoni authenticated and signed the warrant on behalf of the West German court and sent it to his government in Buenos Aires. Once in Buenos Aires, the document had to go through the West German embassy to the Argentine Ministry of Foreign and Religious Affairs, who then gave it to the President of the Senate, José María Guido. Guido sent it to the Procurator General, who in turn assigned it to Judge Raúl Centeno of Federal Court No. 1. Finally, on June 30, 1960, 1 year and 23 days after extradition proceedings were begun, the case was assigned to Judge Jorge Luque of District Court No. 3. Only then could the police begin their search for Mengele. But the question of extradition, if Mengele were caught, would be decided by the court. News of the West German extradition request broke in the last week of June, while Argentine President Arturo Frondizi was on a state visit to Bonn. Frondizi told a press conference that his country had no intention of sheltering criminals from the justice they deserve. But, he said, the West Germans would have to provide proof of Mengele's crimes before he was sent back for trial. Smarting from the Eichmann kidnapping just 2 months before, the president said, some form of reparations would be sought from the Israeli government. By contrast, a letter to the Herald Tribune in Paris that day expressed a view shared by many people around the world. Rather than considering the question of punishment of the Israeli volunteers for their abduction of Eichmann, would it not be better to send them back once more to gather up Mengele for us as well? Surely something has gone quite wrong, and we have become somewhat distracted from the vital needs of justice when we begin bickering and feeling that sovereign rights have been dangerously imperiled. In Paraguay, meanwhile, Mengele's friends greeted with disbelief the news that he was wanted for atrocities in Auschwitz. Captain Alejandro von Eckstein said, when it did start to come out, he told us he was forced to do some of those experiments, and he really did not carry out the experiments that so much has been written about. He made the remark that he had to do what he was ordered to do, because if he didn't carry out the orders, they would throw him in the same area as where the others were. He also said he helped many people who were very sick in the camp, but that none of his good work was reported. Mengele's other citizenship sponsor, Werner Jung, said he was shocked, really shocked. I didn't get a chance to ask him about it, because I had already gone back to Germany when it came out. But Jung's wife, Margaret, is still convinced that the allegations were lies. She even claimed that Mengele's Auschwitz pathologist, Miklos Niesli, who provided the most detailed statement about his experiments, is a pseudonym and never existed. Werner Schubius, one of Jung's business colleagues, who still lives in Asunción, also believed the allegations were invented. When we met him, we said, he can't possibly have done these things. I'm convinced of that. If he did something, it was only because he was acting under orders. I can imagine Mengele only as a human being, and as a human being he has my sympathy. He was modest and well-educated, much more educated than we are. But on the west coast of America, one former friend of Mengele's was stunned. Opening his morning newspaper, the Jewish textile executive from Buenos Aires saw a picture of the man with whom he had nearly gone into partnership several years before. I simply did not believe it, he said. I immediately telephoned the girl who had introduced us, and I said to her, to think he'd been our friend. She said they had just got the newspapers too, and all they had done was look at the picture in disbelief. For Mengele, holed up on Alban Krug's farmhouse in southern Paraguay, matters went from bad to worse. Late in July, Mengele's great friend, Federico Haza, the Argentinian architect who had introduced him to so many of his key Paraguayan contacts, fell off a ladder at a construction site in Asunción and died. It is clear from Mengele's gloomy diary entry for July 31st that the combined effects of the Eichmann kidnapping, the Argentine warrant for his arrest, and Haza's death had caused him to consider suicide. Like the rain that has covered the earth, sorrow has come over me. A good old unselfish friend has left me forever. The loss of him is irreplaceable for me, anyway. For the moment, I can only force myself to believe that I will never be able to see that friend again, who was always so optimistic and prepared for a joke in any kind of situation. He still lives in me. The proof of his goodwill and helpfulness and comradeship are too much alive for me to imagine that only a couple of days ago we said goodbye forever. But thus it seems to be. The radio report has brought certainty. But his spirit and his love have left so much indistinguishable impact that this friend will always be present with us. It was he who told me to hold out and gave me new strength when I was doubting the future sense of life. You must not give up now and lose your nerve. That's exactly what the others want with their hunt, he told me, and we said goodbye late in the night. Your words, my dear friend, will be your last legacy and my deepest duty. Mengele remained in this maudlin state for several days after Haza's death, and he was too frightened to attend the funeral. On August 5th, he wrote, "Again and again, my thoughts are with the tragic fate of my good friend. He must be resting under the earth by now. If only I could help take care of his wife. Is the son back from D, Deutschland, yet? He does lose something irreplaceable in his father. The death of his father has caused a break in the course of his development, both mental and professional." Mengele soon had another source of anguish. By August, detailed stories about his crimes were appearing in the German press. A batch of magazine and newspaper reports were delivered to him by a friend he called Don C., who landed at a private airstrip near the Krug's farm. All of a sudden I heard the sound of an engine. It was the arrival of Don C., Mengele wrote, on August 15th. He had taken the chance to come by. We spent a nice Sunday afternoon and talked about the painful event and many personal questions. That night, Mengele read through the press reports, which fascinated me until deep into the night. He went to bed deeply disturbed. Jews, he was sure, were behind the lies blackening his name. It is unbelievable what is allowed to be slanderously written in German magazines. The magazines are the illustrated proof of the lack of character and lack of proper attitude of the current German government that tolerates such self-defilement. The political lie triumphs, and time and history have been warped and bowed. It drips of humanitarianism and Christianity, and in this, God is the most often quoted. Behind all this stands only one thing, that is, all the Old Testament hate toward everything in the German consciousness, heroic and truly superior. At about this time, a typist in the West German embassy in Asunción came face to face with Mengele while visiting the German colony of Colonia Independencia, where she dislocated her ankle. On her return to Asunción, She told the embassy staff that a German doctor named Mengele had reset it. She did not know that he was a wanted Nazi and asked why the embassy had no record of a German doctor by that name living in the area. The chargé d'affaires, Peter Bench, went to southern Paraguay to investigate. I made some inquiries, and it was clear to me that Mengele had been there under his own name. He was not practicing as a doctor full-time, but on an occasional basis, I thought, because he depended on the goodwill of the local people. There was no secret about his name, but I, personally, never found him. I met Alban Krug. He did not admit that he had helped Mengele, although it was clear that he had helped several Nazis coming over the border from Argentina. The incident raises important questions about the degree of coordination and determination of the West German hunt. Despite Bench's breakthrough in Paraguay, his colleagues in the Buenos Aires embassy 1,000 miles away were pressing sedately on with their extradition request to the Argentinians. There appears to have been no attempt by the Foreign Office in Bonn to resolve these conflicting clues as to Mengele's exact location by putting their own agents on the ground. The West Germans were hunting Mengele with pieces of paper from embassies.